Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
What's up, all you big stinky buttholes? Is buttholes worse than anus? I never knew. I could never tell which word is worse. It's Toby. I'm doing the intro. Millions of people asked for me to do it again. They're tired of Matt, and I can understand why. So, we're glad to have you. I got a couple of announcements. One, Devin and I are doing Songs and Stories Tour. There's a lot of shows, so go to emorymusic.com. You can check that out. Get your tickets. They're selling fast, and I do mean quickly. Also, there's a site we run here, Matt and I. We own it. It's called marriagesupply.com, and it is a place for sex products, sex toys, all those things that you want to get to spice up your life. And I created a code to celebrate October because I love Oktoberfest and I love Halloween. Use promo code October and you get 10% off. Go there. Time's running out. You want to go ahead and get all the stuff you need to spice up your October, if you know what I mean. And I think you do. All right. Today's show is sponsored by Brooklinen. These are the best sheets I've ever slept on, I promise you. Get 15% off and free shipping when you use promo code BADCHRISTIAN at brooklinen.com. Let's do this.
Oh, hell yeah, God showed up.
I don't give a shit what I put in my body.
You don't ever f***ing talk to me that way.
So if you've never done oral, then you're extra virgin.
No, girl, it's my flesh.
I showed my dad my penis when I was 25 years old. You don't get more honest than that.
3, 2, 1! Remix.
Where you going with that big old ass? I don't really want to know, but I gotta ask. Where you going with that big old ass?
Where you going?
I really want to know, but I gotta ask.
I love that one.
Where you going with that big old ass? I don't really want to know, but I gotta ask.
That's good.
Yeah, you like that, don't you? It's the Bad Christian Podcast.
You got to credit the person that makes the beat. You got it? We'll catch it later, but you got to get that into praise.
Matt Moore, that was awesome. Thank you for doing that with my song. Yeah, so those are our, I ride around in my car, or I'm walking around the house, and I just get these thoughts and songs and raps in my head, and I just have to get them out. And so some of the clubbers and people out there are putting some beats to them, and that one's pretty good.
Okay, so that one, also, I mean, that is along the lines of something that took you how long to do? Like, you came up with that line in less than a second. It just popped in your head, and you said a line, and then somebody else put the music to it, and now tens of thousands of people are enjoying it, and that's so amazing.
But yeah, that's what's so fun. So we'll let clubbers have first dibs at it. But
we're moving forward on the whole situation here of, we've had a focus, I have personally, and I think everybody else too, the more you get older and realize that doing creative stuff is its own value and then tends to work out anyway. And so we've been working harder on just I've been trying to focus all my time on less businessy stuff and more on editing and creative and questions and writing and interview skills and songs and doing music all the time on Emoryland. And we're even doing that a bit more. We're doing those Christmas songs too now. So we're doing this whole Christmas album and we're doing Christmas songs for other people. So you've been doing that with your time too, right?
Yes, Matt, you're right. I've been writing songs. So we came up with this idea last year. We just thought, what would it be like? We know we get so many fans and people ask us here and there, would you ever write a song for me? You know, we're getting married, or it'd be awesome for a gift for Christmas. And we're like, okay, let's just do it. So there's only limited spots because it does take, even though I'm really, really fast and really great at writing these songs, there's only so much time. But you can go to the emorymusic.com, go to the store right at the top, and there's three different options there, and we will write a song for you. And you can give it as a gift, you can give it to yourself. We can do a couple of different things. One, we'll just write the whole song for you on acoustic guitar. Devin and I'll sing it. Two, we could also mix and master it for you. And three, we could even do like kind of a full production recording for you. Yeah. You can go check it out.
We already got some of those signed up too, which is great. I mean, because it's like a low pressure situation.
Yep.
But it's going to be good, and it's fun. First of all, we're good at writing songs and arranging them and recording them.
Yeah.
And it's fun, and it's creative. And it turns out that, you know, there's some money there that's worth doing. You know, the money's just enough to take the friction out of it. It's worth it.
It's so fun writing these songs because, okay, for me, in Emory, when I write a song, so much of Toby's identity is wrapped up in it. But when I'm writing this song, like I wrote a song yesterday, a lady's buying this for her fiance, and they might even play this song as their first dance. And I'm like, ooh, okay. This is, yeah. You know, it's got to sound good. So what I did was stand in my room with my guitar and kind of move left and right like I was dancing. You know, what would it look like? And I just came up with this song. I'm like, oh, they're going to love this. And I just feel so good about it because this sounds funny. I know there's a couple of lines that I wrote that are just going to make them cry. They're going to look at each other when that line hits and they're going to cry. And all. And I'm just so, it's like, it feels so good. Like I'm writing with a purpose outside of myself.
Yes, it's not just to crap out something or monetize your thing. It's not that. It's when you write an Emory song, it's got to land. It's important, and it's got to land, and it's got to do everything for everybody. It feels that way in a way. But yes. If you're creating something that is meaningful to one person, like a joke, for instance, if I make a joke to a person with context, it will matter. It will be funny. It wouldn't work for anybody else, but it will be meaningful and funny to this person in this moment. Yes, that is the fun stuff in life. And so to write one song to make these two people who you know a little bit enough about them and the situation, how fun is that? Because the goal is to make those two people cry, and you can achieve that goal.
I know.
That's a really cool way to use creativity, and it's meaningful, and it's not mass. It's the opposite of commercial pop bullshit that the computers are going to be able to one day do. That's awesome.
And I'm able to write lyrics outside of my personal experience, mm-hmm. which is really freeing too. And so that's what's really neat. Like these are, I mean, I know I'm tooting my own horn. These are great songs. They really are. Like, I mean, some of the chord progressions, the lyrics, the melodies. I mean, we might use parts of these songs in Emory songs in the future or something like that. It's a great writing experience. It's really mm-hmm. fun, and it makes a great present. So, like we said, go over to emorymusic.com, get your present now. I mean,
it's
a personalized song from your
Emory
favorite
music.
Band on earth is a pretty good gift to give somebody or give yourself for the Christmas holidays. But moving on, Matt, I've been writing music, and I know you've been working on music. We got speaking of Emory, we got that next installment coming out. You've been working mm-hmm. on that too,
right? Oh yeah, Christmas songs is so much fun. I've done this so wrong, and almost everybody in the music business that is successful does this wrong. It's like a hoarding thing. You go, oh, these Emory songs, when we write them and put them on the album, they're so important, they're going to make or break our career. They're worth tens of thousands of dollars each, and they're so important. So I have to be so careful with them and stuff in a way that you don't want to just write songs unless it's for that and you put all your effort into it, but it's wrong. That's hoarding. That's creativity hoarding. You're way better off to write songs every day and plan on not using them or somebody else taking them or not finishing them all the way because you're in a more creative mode and you just build the skills and then you have more creativity, not less. It's not a finite resource, how much you can create. You don't run out of it. You just get better at it and make more better. It's crazy to think the opposite way. I'm so disappointed that I didn't understand that for a long enough time. Anyway, I'm enjoying the output part of life at the moment. I'm working with Dan Koch on his podcast, and I help him I don't know what you would call the role, just development. But his
consultations?
Yeah, and it's just going really good. His show keeps growing, and he's doing good research and all that stuff. But I was listening to his last episode yesterday, and he had a guy on there that's like a counselor for marriage and family that just talks people through that are, you know, changing their faith, basically. And they stumbled into this thing. I don't remember if he said it or Dan said it, but it hit me in a way that I thought it was pretty profound because they said, I think Dan said that they were talking about inerrancy and how important that is and how difficult it is to leave that or to let that go. That seems to be one of the main hangups that people cross the threshold of that. You know what I mean? Like there's that, once you let go of inerrancy, things are going to be different, but it seems, and there's a lot of pressure to do that. And some people do, some people don't.
That's a huge hurdle.
Right. But we're in the middle of this like thing happening culturally where it's not just me, it's not just bad Christian listeners, but people are changing their faith and the way they apply their faith and spirituality.
Yeah.
And Dan said something like millions of people right now, it's got to be true. There are millions of people who are like married, who are Christians, who are, their faith is changing in a direction, right?
Millions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
I mean, something like that, order of magnitude. And it, that, I didn't thought about it in that, in those terms, but it, for a lot of those, it's not, for many of those, it's not equal. One person is like going a different direction than the other, or willing to go farther, or one person, one of the spouses wants to more stay, like crossing the inerrancy line, for instance. He said that's, it's just not very good if one spouse is in that, one's not. But on the other hand, you're just kind of crossing a threshold to some degree. So you've got all these couples where one spouse is on some other side of a thing. So there's a lot of friction.
Yes.
And a lot of and tens and thousands, tens of thousands of these marriages, in a way that wasn't a decade ago, now have a schism in it. And I was like, oh yeah. And it's also true politically. Now that you said, when he said that, I was thinking about my parents. So like, basically after the 2016 election and stuff, I noticed my parents were like, wait a minute, they're not exactly aligned anymore. It, like, you can see that they weren't, in a way. Like, they would fight about Trump or something. Like, my dad's not a big Trump supporter. My mom is just a South Carolina lady.
And that's after
lady.
Decades of marriage. That,
yeah. And
that
never,
rift started happening.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, and, you know, and stuff like that. So I'm like, and so politically and religiously and in a lot of ways, I mean, I don't know what that looks like, but it just started like to be that way. And so it must be beyond just religion. And you know, luckily for my mom, she died because she had to deal with Trump and my dad. That's, you know,
luckily for her.
Yeah, luckily for her. She, and I'm saying that as a joke, but she, it might be true. I mean, it might just be true. Like, she was not happy about the way things were headed. Like, it was a great deal of stress for her. And it was a stress in their marriage for the brief amount of time that it was like 6 months after Trump got elected before she died. But it wasn't, it was weird like that. So I'm thinking, why is that? And what's, first of all, I don't know what's going on with divorce rate or marriage or relationships or just the social fabric. It might, is in somewhat of trouble with a rapid change going on.
Yeah.
And one of the things that makes me think of is there must be a bubble of sorts here where, because when things change all at once, it's like a bubble. So I'm thinking, tell me if it sounds crazy, that there's some kind of amount of, I don't want this to sound like a reach, but I'm wondering, is it possible that in decades past, there have not been enough, I've heard this enough times to speculate it, that a lot of women didn't feel free to have, like, they didn't really have a choice as much as you would have thought they did of what they were doing spiritually or politically. They're just kind of, do you know what I mean?
They didn't have a choice?
They felt like they had to go along to get along.
Yeah.
More than I understood was going on for, I don't know,
yes,
forever. Like, I just thought, well, what do you mean? This is what we do. It's what I do. It's what you do. I choose. You choose. But I'm starting to be sensitive to the fact that I hear women's stories and they say stuff like, well, that's really all I could do in the culture. I mean, it's not just my husband, but the church and this person and my family. And there's all these reasons why you just, and that makes a ton of sense. Like, you just get along. You got to go along to get along. But if it was available to you to express these other thoughts and communities and digital and online, and plus with Christianity and the right wing people getting nuttier, it's like, and women being more liberated, be able to communicate like that, I think that's why things are changing so fast, is because they, I guess, were holding things that we didn't know that they were holding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was just to keep the peace or just to go along with whatever the system or the culture or the group.
And not in a totally fake way, just in a nudge way that adds up over time and creates
maybe not even it, not even totally realizing it. Like, there's tons of, I think it was revisionist history or whatever, they were talking about just some of the racism back in the day. It's not that everybody really agreed that the bathroom should be separate, but they weren't going to say anything.
Right.
You know, because you cause a big hubbub and you just did. And so that's a little bit, that probably even speaks to the micro, what a microaggression is. But yes, you just, you know, it was just there. You just, well, it's going to be really hard to pick this moment in the grocery store to stand up for civil rights.
Oh, no, I don't want to get out of bed.
That's how I feel every morning when I wake up and just laying in those perfect Brooke linen sheets. My goodness, they are my favorite sheets I've ever owned in my life. And I'm just going to be honest, I never thought about sheets. I was just being a single dude and even a married dude. I just, Jess, we can't afford those expensive sheets. And who knows if they're any good. Now, Brooke linen changed everything. Changed the game. I can afford amazing, great sheets. The best sheets ever. Better than any hotel. Better than any house I slept in the world. They are my favorite sheets. Seriously. I mean, this is such a cool company. They are making your home beautiful and with their product. And also, you spend a third of your life in between the sheets. Don't you want to be insanely comfortable? I know that's what I wanted to do. These are luxury sheets. They have towels, bedding, and more without all that luxury markup. I'm telling you, they're just great. Sheets don't just feel great, but they look great too. And you can mix and match over 20 plus colors and patterns. So my Brooke linen sheets are the most comfortable sheets I've slept on. I said that. I believe it. I'm telling you, you should too. And their towels have turned my bathroom into a spa. It's just getting crazier and crazy. Brooke linen is doing it. It's making my life amazing. I couldn't recommend them more for friends, family, or treating yourself to the upgrade you deserve. So brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get 10% off and free shipping when you use promo code BADCHRISTIAN at brooklinen.com. Brooke linen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. I said lifetime warranty. The only way to get the 10% off and free shipping is to use promo code BADCHRISTIAN at brooklinen.com. That's BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code BADCHRISTIAN. Brooke linen, these are the best sheets ever.
Yeah, so women have just had a lot of pressure on them to do certain things. And so, Reva, does that sound at all, is that way off far going farther with that?
No, you're right on so far.
Okay, good.
I'm a little unclear on the bubble, though.
The bubble is the fact that once, bubble. Well, bubbles pop. So the idea being there's this problem that's unknown and unseen
kind
and then it pops
the
quickly.
Surface.
Yeah. And then when it happens, okay. Now that you can join all these Facebook groups and do this and the other side's getting weirder and people in mass are changing their religion and politics, it's like, okay, now, and women have become incredibly empowered in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So not enough, whatever, but come on, we're really making some movement here. I find that very positive. I notice it a lot. I had a daughter 5 and 6 years ago. So I've just kind of, I don't know, I've just been paying attention to the space a little bit. And Bridget and I are farther off than we were on some things, but that's okay. I mean, it's just, oh yeah. I mean, we don't have to be locked into this religious system. She's kind of thinks different things and I think different things and it's more free. So I think that's very positive in a general way. It may have some really bad effects in societally or the marriage institution or what. I have no idea. We don't know, but it's happening and it's happening kind of fast. So what is the problem there or the interesting thing is that's just a very little marker though, because if that's true, that must be true even wider. So now I'm starting to just think, and I've noticed this lately too, there are so many women that are just, they're obviously very powerful, but there's a lot of really powerful women that have not been able to, I don't know, preach or be the leader of the family or have a career because of these simple forces all combined. So you have these extremely powerful women that are now just running households or something. And that's kind of a shame. So if things are changing fast, the thing to be on the lookout for is what is this generation and more so the next, what will these extremely powerful women that have been kind of domestic going to do? Good or bad? I mean, like, what will they choose to do? They're going to get more choice in what to do. They have it.
Yeah.
It's already here and it's going to increase insane. And I keep thinking about like, oh my God, that woman's totally runs everything in this family and beyond, but from the sideline or from behind the man and all that. Like all those women are going to go do shit now. Or a lot more. A lot of women already did, of course. There's empowered people in the 60s and 70s, but now it's everybody.
Though. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just, you're going to see a lot there. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, what do you think might happen? I mean,
That's a wild thought. I guess I have had thoughts like this before.
Like,
but
here they come.
You're saying something like, well, obviously, women have shown tons of skills and have had these skills and have grown these skills, running a fantasy CEO of a family, which, I mean, is way too far underrated of how hard that is. Also, managing the husband and the money. And, I mean, Jess has done so much stuff that I could never actually possibly do. Like, I mean, she works and does things that I actually can't do. And so you're saying that that is a what is it going to look like
when
finally it breaks free and there isn't that anymore. And then lots of women are in charge.
Now, I don't know about it. I don't know. I'm not saying in charge. All I'm saying is, what are they going to do?
No more pressure to like hold back and be quiet anymore.
The pressures are being eliminated rapidly. So the freedom for women is increasing rapidly.
Yes.
And the opportunity, I mean, not to mention the affirmative placement and there's that part. That's the dumb part of it where Marvel makes goofy scenes in movies that are, I mean, that's the beginnings of like getting the things rolling. I mean, I think that stuff's kind of goofy, but it speaks to
elementary in a way.
Yeah. That's just a relatively immature thing, but it's a signal of what is happening. I think I'm starting to see it more that way or something like that. So I have a high curiosity about, you know, what will happen next. You think it might even be negative on marriage?
Yeah, I'm
like, it's going to cause a lot of divorces, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm a bad person to ask about marriage because I don't know if I think it's good for anybody anymore. I told Reva today, don't ever get married. Don't you dare take what you have and think less of. Don't you diminish your life right now, Reva. This is some man. Don't you dare let him take away whatever. But marriage is gone anyway. Yeah, well, it will just be something that... Well,
I'm talking about existing marriages, though, that got married on the pretense and then the world changed. That's what I'm saying is a weird... That's like...
Yes.
We're seeing a bubble begin to burst or
well, it's
or
the same something. Thing. It's the same thing as church. You grew up and you say, I need this church thing. Well, wait a minute. I was just told that. Do I actually need church? Do I actually need marriage?
Right.
I got lots of ideas. Right. I got things I want to get done. And so, yeah, marriage is going to definitely take a hit.
I mean, it might be, I'm not even saying the world's going to improve or they're going to be so, I don't know what they'll choose and I don't know what they'll do or if it'll be good or bad or what the unintended consequences will be. But I feel like this is kind of, it does feel exciting to me.
Yeah.
You know, I think I can keep my marriage together and stuff, but I mean, overall,
well, I think there's already been a shift of like more divorces and that kind of stuff, but I think it'll even out, but probably at a lower rate than it has been in the past.
Yeah.
As far as like the amount of marriages and how long they last and that kind of stuff.
But what will women choose is the question. That's what's it's going to be. I mean, nobody knows yet.
I guess kind of crazy to watch how traditionally male or female jobs in the past, nurses, teachers, who will go for those jobs still and what that'll look like.
Yeah. But creative
and
then
also you're talking about all these pressures that have held women back, which is 100% true. And then welcome to a whole new world of pressures you will be exposed to now.
That's
true. You know what I mean? Lots of the reasons men are the way they are is because the way things have been for men as well. Men die earlier. Men have a higher suicide rate. Men have a lot of issues that are wrapped up with their identity and their work and their success.
That's true.
And those things will be taken on by women too now. More so. Like, I mean, lots of people feel completely unfulfilled in their life because of their work and their careers. That won't be something that you're going to get there and go, wait a minute, this isn't what I thought it would be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? True. Like, hold on. That other stuff was good too. Like that the worst thing I hate on earth is anytime somebody fucking shits on a mom as if that's not work or a great job. My wife didn't work in corporate world for several years and I couldn't have been more impressed with her work skills and effort and energy and time and all that stuff. I mean, that is what's really crazy. And so anytime that is what I hope doesn't happen, where it's something amazing and beautiful that in my opinion, only women can do is be that mom. It's just unbelievable. I am more impressed by that almost than any technology on earth that a mom can do the things that she does. And so I hope that that doesn't go away. Not that everybody's supposed to be that. And there's tons of women that don't want to be moms. I get that.
Well, yeah, but that's kind of the exciting part, is that like gender norms are going away more so to where like people can do what they're naturally good at, you know?
Yeah.
And like people's skills and desires and abilities and goals, those things will be the driver versus like what you should do or shouldn't do because of what gender you are.
Yep. Yeah, I think that it'll be real interesting to see. But
what if, can I ask a question? Yeah. And this is just a total what if, what Reba just said. What if it just shows that women are better at being moms?
We don't really know.
What if we'll data actually is like, oh, wait, it turned out like this because the data is right. For example, you know what I mean? Like, I have
like
kids,
if their salaries go up and happiness goes way down, what would that mean?
Or what if families and children
be a lot of
take an ungodly hit? What if like, oh, wait a minute. Holy shit. Women have been holding the entire world together. And we didn't, like I said, everybody diminishes that. And it might like be everything. What if being a mom is more important than anything on earth? And we just don't know it. But I mean, there might be real, good news would be.
I think it's pretty important.
I actually think it's maybe the most important thing. I think that. I really do believe that.
The activity of, okay, well, all right. That brings me to a different side of the coin here. One of the worst things that exists is when you have people that are repressed or suppressed or held back or something bad, and then it goes bad, and they have a border collie stuck in an apartment. I use as an analogy a lot because it seems wrong. You know what I mean? Like this dog's supposed to get out and run and do all the stuff. Now, these women that I'm talking about, I think about it this way, and this just speaks to me saying that they're powerful, okay? There's so many rich white women, and like I talk about them at the school that Georgia goes to, and that's all this stuff. They are, some of these people are so powerful, but they should be out in the world doing other things. They always should have been. In addition to being a mom, of course, instead, all of their power and energy and force and productivity is forced on helicopter bulldozer parenting, wokeness, consumerism. I think part of the consumerism thing is this too. It's unbelievably powerful women with appetites and money and drive and desire and ability stuck in the house, and they're on Amazon, and they're over-parenting their kid, and they're doing the over-woke bullshit, all of that stuff. Driving these,
woke-splaining everybody.
All that stuff that's a symptom. So I do not think that rich white women are bad guys. I do think they're causing many problems, but the reason is because they probably the same thing we're talking about. They're border collie in an apartment. Of course they're going to overparent their kids. Of course they're going to go crazy on social media on something about justice. Those are good impulses overdriven in a narrow field because we're limited in a holistic integrated life. So I'm not mad at them for all the harm they cause, because my goodness, I think rich elite white women are a big problem. I really do. I think they're the ones that try to control people and censor. They do a lot of shit that drives me crazy. But I think if I look at it from another point of view, I'm very excited for them to get redirected. Does that make sense?
Yeah, just harness that and put it towards something productive. Yeah.
Yes, because you're fucking these kids up. You're doing some really bad shit out there on the internet and controlling people and trying to
because that's in the name of trying to help the world.
Yeah.
It's backfired in a way because they haven't had the outlet or the tunnel or path or the way there to get there.
Yeah, so I am naming the rich white women as a problem. And they're not mentally healthy either. That's another sign that something is kind of wrong here. Like, a lot of them have crippling anxiety and depression. I mean, it's very obvious. And a ton of energy cooped up will give you, I've seen it in a new way. But they've been put in a horrible situation, and we hopefully will redirect their abilities to other things instead of you know, going crazy with the schools and buying shit on Amazon. I don't know.
But I will say this, and I think you're right, and this is what I don't want people to do. The biggest problem with, I would even say the thing that's most frustrating is, lots of times I hear the left or people who are woke, I put that in quotation marks, saying really awesome, great ideas and thoughts, and it could really be valuable to this world. And in, all they're doing is just stuffing it into the world that they don't like. Like, yeah. Hey, women should work the same jobs that men do. Wait a minute. Hold on. The men got there.
You're freer than
bad
that.
You're way better than that.
Yeah, you're freer than that.
Do not fall for that. You can do more than that. Those men aren't all horrible men. The system fucked them over too. And they're in these jobs and these things that that they don't even understand either. Yeah. There's a lot of that mental disability mental illness and issues and anxieties and fears and worries and anger and all that stuff is there too. So don't just fall for that. Like, hey, we want the exact same thing as
the
side. Yeah. We don't know. You're better than that. Technology. Let's create. Let's don't just
create
this
the right way.
Creation because is the only way.
If you're not creating, then I'm going to suggest you're controlling, and you got to please, you've got to stop trying to control other people. That is going to backfire on you anyway. People are smelling it. I see other people talking about it. It's going to be a topic. It's the next group that's going to be looked at poorly. It will be rich white women. I'm warning them. I'm for them. I'm saying let's start creating and doing things. If you're going to sit back and want to control your family and people on the internet, and then this what happens to that's not the right, you know, this is your opportunity to not do that.
I know that,
you know.
If you had so this is what you're saying. You have an unbelievable valuable resource, and all you're going to do is use that resource and energy into this bad machine that screwed up all the other resources.
Yep.
No, you wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
You're not going to do that. You don't just take the valuable resource, like rich white women, obviously, as a unbelievable potential, has so much potential. And if you just waste it on the same shit that didn't work for the guys, you know, everybody right now, when you think of the bad group of people on earth, it's middle class, white, cisgender males, right?
Right.
Now, the rest of the world has no culpability in that.
Well, see,
the system and all that stuff. I'm not saying there's plenty of responsibility on my shoulders right here for that as well. But I'm saying don't push women into the things that fucked up the other side.
Yeah, they're the other half, and often the drivers of these men that you hate so much, the women counterpart is there also. And I mean, it is true that that rich white women, they're controlling most of the economy. Like, I was complaining about Amazon's work culture. I know somebody that works there and it's going really bad. And I was thinking, well, I guess that's what their culture's like through and through, but that's, you know, I'm thinking, well, I guess we're the consumers. And I think, oh yeah, but if you look at the stats, it's like all the commerce is done by a very small amount of people. It's powerful, rich. Why? I mean, I'm way overgeneralizing, but you know what I'm saying. They drive the household. They're doing everything they can. So let's
men's products are marketed to women too. People know it.
Yeah, it's all marketed to
college campuses are filled with white women.
Yeah, that's right.
Men are going less and less to school. There's all kinds of things. And so what we're saying is, or at least that's what I'm hearing, is it is valuable. It's a resource. Not placing blame here, but you're...
No, I'm saying we got to help them.
Well, yeah, the blame is more in the system.
Yeah,
we're in a unique spot to use this, though, to help these this unbelievable resource of brain and wealth and money and time and all this stuff to really make a real difference.
When you peel back the curtain... Soon enough, they are going to be on the hot seat. You're going to see that they're going to be next after cis white men or whatever. I mean, they're next, and for good reason. So anyway, I'm trying to put that all together without being critical or
just thinking out loud.
Whatever, but just thinking out loud, but we'll see.
Fire!
You're listening to The Thread, the newest single from The Devil Wears Prada. Love those guys. Been friends with them a long time. The Thread is one of the songs from their new record, The Act, which came out this past Friday on Solid State Record. It rules. So go check it out. Seriously. The Devil Wears Prada will be on a full U.S. tour this fall with Norma Jean and Gideon. Man, what a great lineup. So head over to their website for tickets. Make sure to follow the band on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you listen to music to make sure you don't miss any updates or new music. The Act is out everywhere now, so go dig into it and just listen to it. You're going to love it. All right, so I'm kind of excited about our guest today. It's David Morrell, and so I was on Twitter. I followed David on Twitter because I like your Twitter comments, and I've been a fan of Rambo since I was a little kid. So when I found out you wrote Rambo, because when I was a little kid, I thought Sylvester Stallone wrote it, or you know that he was so popular to my childhood. I grew up in the 80s, and so
so it wasn't written by Stallone.
Rocky and Rambo.
From the mind of a Morrell.
Yeah. Well, it's just to be clear, it's a novel called First Blood that was published in 1972 and then adapted into the films that Sylvester starred in.
Right. And so that's why I thought it was so interesting to follow you. And so I was on Twitter and right now the latest version of this, these films, the Rambo films, is coming out. And so I tweeted on there because, interestingly enough, David, you actually do kind of look like my dad a little bit. My dad has always had a mustache. He wears glasses. You're kind of a thinner gentleman. And so, I was like, whoa, this is kind of interesting. My last name's Morrell. Usually, I don't know that many Morrells.
Are your ancestors or whatever from Britain?
I think they are, but we haven't really done that's as far as I've gotten. I think, yes, a little bit.
My father, who died when I was very, very young, was from the UK. He was a British citizen.
Oh.
And he was he died in combat. He was a Royal Navy aviator, which is a kind of interesting combination. And he had traveled to, I was raised in Southern Ontario in Canada, and he had come to Southern Ontario to train Canadian flyers for World War II. I'm 76, so I would have, I was born in 43 when, all that, when the training was occurring and all. And then he was called back and he died during the D-Day operations. His job was to fly over the French coast and see where the naval shells were landing and then to advise them about how to adjust their trajectory.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Not a healthy way to earn a living.
Right. Wow. That's, but I mean, I guess that definitely informed you then. I mean, he passed away. How old were you when?
He died in 44, so I would have been a year old. But it impressed me that I'm saying that wrong. It had an impression on me in a powerful way because I grew up without a father, so to speak. My mother eventually remarried, and that wasn't a successful marriage. They argued a lot. But when I was young, I remember going to other people's homes, and there was this man hanging around. I was trying to figure out what he was doing there. And that's when I learned that somebody had a father, and what was that about? And so in a certain way, as I grew up, my fixation was about male authority figures and looking for father substitutes. And I was fortunate enough to find adult males who were able to guide me in ways that I think were productive. Most of them were writers who really nudged me along, and I wouldn't have had a career without the help of these people.
Well, that's what I kind of, yeah, go ahead.
Your whole life you've been then authority, I mean, from the military to, like, even in First Blood, the cops and the military conflict and all that. Has that stuff been on your mind your whole life?
Well, in the novel First Blood, while in the movie, played by Brian Dennehy, the police chief is basically Sylvester Stallone's age. That it's essentially a brother conflict.
Okay.
And whereas in the novel, the police chief, Wilfred Teasel, is old enough to be Rambo's father. And he is clearly from an earlier generation. These wars don't mean anything to anybody anymore. But at the time, the Korean War in the 50s was a big deal. And Teasel was a decorated veteran of Korea, thought he understood what war was about. And then he meets Rambo, who is, you know, from an entirely different war, a guerrilla war. Mm-hmm. And so it was meant to be a contrast in generations, a father-son story, the different war types of war, lots of contrasts in it. And it's worth pointing out that you mentioned my mustache. I grew that in 1968 as kind of research for the role, because there were hundreds of riots in the United States in 1968. Some of them were related to the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. Some of them were politically related, such as what was called by an official task force, a police riot outside the Democratic Convention in 1968 in Chicago, where the Democrats were preparing to nominate somebody to run for president. And there were these hundreds of riots against all of this. And the war protesters tended to be to look like rebellious. They had very long hair. They had beards. And I had this idea that this decorated war veteran would come back from Vietnam and grow long hair and a beard, mm-hmm. and would be treated the way nearly everybody was treated who had long hair and beards at that time. It's hard, if you didn't live at that time, it's hard not to be aware of what it was like. And I grew my mustache. That was about as far as I was willing to go, but I grew a mustache just to see. And oh, what a difference it made. Authority wow. figures, law enforcement, what have you, clearly didn't like my looks and would often comment about it as I walked down the street and things like that. Wow. So I was, I mean, it was a aggressive time. I kept the mustache because my dear wife, I've been married for more than 50 years, and my wife has basically only known me with a mustache. So she doesn't want me to shave it off lest she not know who she's married to.
Mm-hmm. So that is that something that they got? that point illustrates, I guess, that that in the movie they changed it to the brother conflict kind of thing and cast a younger good actor. Is that frustrating? Do you think that really changes the movie?
No, not at all. The movie, books and movies are different. And Stephen King once said to me, Steve is a friend, and when he taught creative writing at the University of Maine, First Blood was one of his texts, along with Double Indemnity by James M. Cain. So he knew the novel well. And he said to me when he saw the movie, he thought I got treated about as well as a novelist can get treated, because he actually recognized the plot. And that's not always something that can be said for books that are adapted into films. And you know, I know my way around movies, and I knew it wouldn't be the same. In fact, I'm amazed that it's as much like the book as it is. There are key differences. One is the police chief has moved into the background, whereas in the book, he gets equal time. The book alternates chapters, Rambo, Teasel, Rambo, Teasel. Yeah. And the whole idea was that they can't get out of their viewpoints to see the other character, to get in the other character and understand him. It's as it were, the viewpoints of the novel are what the novel is about, how people get locked into their prejudices on both sides. And now I forgot my train of thought. I got so interested in the viewpoint issue. Remind me where we were before that.
Well, I'm curious, based on this whole thing, I mean, hearing about your story and your dad and military stuff and the era you're coming in now, and it seems just from hearing you talk for a second, you've got a really good grip on history. So I'm curious now if you, if you've seen the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary and stuff like that, but it seems like there's so many parallels from that era to today. So I'm kind of curious from your point of view, if you've got what you've got in that department.
There is that, and now I remember what we were talking about, the differences in the book and the movie, and the movie has a drastically different ending than what is in the book. All in all, if we take the film on its own terms, it's coherent, it's well-made, it's well-acted. I've introduced the film many times in theaters, and in fact, I even supplied an audio commentary talking about the differences in, you know, the interesting parallels or contrasts on Blu-ray DVDs. So, the one difference I would say is that there was the late 1960s were a very violent time in America, and it sort of climaxed with Kent State in Ohio in 1970 when, this is still hard for me to believe, that students protesting the war were shot to death by National Guardsmen. Yeah. And that, you know, that's still a topic that hasn't really, I think, been fully discussed. So the differences there were not only as sharp as they are today, but alas, they were violent. And except for a few cases now, the political differences haven't expressed themselves violently at the way they did, so that almost every night there was a riot on TV. It was a shocking time. So yeah, there's a parallel.
That's what I mean. Does it feel like that time was more violent and shocking and protest and authority? When you look at today, are you saying it's not as bad as it used to be, or we've seen this all before, or are you sounding the alarm for what's happening today with authority?
I don't want to get into talking about, you know, different viewpoints in Rambo and Teasel. What I'm seeing is partly because of social media. A child just walked in behind you and picked up something and walked out. I love it.
That's my daughter.
Well, say hello to her. Social media has made a huge difference in our society. Elements such as racism, which I thought it naively had pretty much been stamped out, turned out were lurking. And that social media allowed pockets of people who felt that they were outcasts and outsiders to communicate with one another and become more powerful than they had thought they were. I see the difference in the culture as one that is being controlled by social media. And I'm just amazed and appalled by how everybody's ready to get in an argument. And I don't know if this is caused because of the tone on Facebook and Twitter. But so far, we're not seeing, we have not had hundreds of riots. And I'm not exaggerating when I say there were hundreds of riots. The inner cities of Gary, Indiana, Detroit, Michigan, L.A., never recovered. In many cases, they're still struggling to overcome the devastation that those riots created.
Mm-hmm. I just heard a podcast that said racism has gotten this is crazy. I think it was Sam Harris, but this lady on there said that the people coming home and the vets coming home from the war and just the existence of the war and that violence wound up having these echoes, and a lot of the people that came home from that wound up paramilitary stuff and got involved with militias, and then the groups are already racist, took those people, and so the whole thing of violence like kind of keeps going, like in some of the militia based
it's a legacy almost.
Yeah, it's like just from causing harm and things from the war and conflict, they just, you know, they continue to echo, you know, through today.
It can be argued, I suppose somebody could do a serious study, and I'm not I don't have the authority to be able to say yes or no on that. If we look back, one legacy of the Vietnam War was that the enemy made drugs readily available through various outlets to American soldiers. And a lot of, and let's face it, it wasn't exactly a happy environment. Right. And perhaps more than any other war, American service people came back from Vietnam with drug habits. Mm-hmm. And that much has been established. And one can argue that, you know, the continuation of American society was affected by the prevalence of drugs that became accepted after the war. You mentioned something about the way Rambo was depicted in the movie, because there he is in the novel with his long hair and his beard, and being picked on the way a police officer, not all, but it would not be unexpected for a police officer to pick on him in 1968. But in the movie in 1982, Sylvester has long hair and he's clean shaven. And when Brian Dennehy says, this isn't quite the line, but this is this is the gist of it. We don't like guys who look like you coming to our town. And people in the audience, men, all looked like Sylvester. Right. They all had long hair, you know, down over their ears and what have you. And I remember watching the movie with an audience, and men were sort of turning to each other saying, well, what's wrong with the way he looks? And if the movie was going to fail, I felt it was going to fail at that moment, that the audience would not accept that police would just look at this guy and say he doesn't look right. Whereas in 1968, with the beard and long hair, they would have said he doesn't look
right. Mm-hmm. Because the 80s are different than the 60s. Do you ever take any, has it ever come up that Rambo's such an icon of violence? And it's in the 80s when we were all obsessed with violence, but Rambo's just an icon of that.
That's what I was going to ask David as well, because the movie is not, he doesn't really kill anybody, but in your book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but in your book, he kills a lot of people.
That's because I wanted to bring the war home. And right. There's, you know, reviewers at the time with the novel, couldn't figure out if there was a hero. And mm-hmm. to me, there weren't any heroes in this. It was two people locked in a deadly conflict and how they got there. And Rambo had come back hating himself for what he had discovered about himself in the war. And the police officer sort of at the wrong time. And Rambo basically gives a line from what's in the movie. There are some thematic parallels, you know, leave me alone or I'll give you a war you won't believe. And I readily acknowledge the degree of violence that's in the novel for the purposes, I mean, in reflecting a violent society in the late 60s, trying to understand what the hell was going on. By the time the movie is made, the character is toned down so that he's now a victim and he's not angry. He then becomes a different sort of character. And it's no secret, I suppose, although some people might be shocked, that in the novel, Rambo dies. He's killed by Colonel Troutman, the man who trained him.
Yeah.
Whereas in the movie, they shot a version in which Rambo commits suicide, takes a weapon from Colonel Troutman and kills himself. Wow. And audiences, this is readily available on current DVDs of the Blu-rays and what have you of the film that have extras. And audiences were not happy because the character had been softened. He was no longer that troubled, angry person from the war, and he was more a victim. The result is that they were able to soften him enough. One character dies at Rambo's hands sort of indirectly when Rambo throws a rock at a helicopter. The man's been shooting at him and he throws the rock. Guy falls out of the helicopter and Rambo runs over to him, and Ted Kotcheff, the director, is known to have instructed Sly is to look at the body as if he's been looking at the carnage that he saw in the war and to be sickened and disturbed by it. And the only other bloodshed is later. Rambo has stolen a military vehicle and four police officers, maybe it's three, in a police car chasing, and they're having a bang bang car fight, where the cars and the truckers are colliding, and they're shooting, and Rambo rams the car off the road and causes a collision with a parked car and there's an explosion. So I guess we could say the body count went up a little bit there, but they aren't really people. They're, we see hands sticking guns out of a window. But that's the body count. Now, and once you get into Rambo 2 and 3, now it's a different matter. You know, that and it seems with each movie, the, you know, it escalated.
Yeah, that's why I was wondering, like, if I almost think, like, looking at the book and then looking at the movie as it came out. So it's obviously that when the movie came out, they were thinking, let's make this character more endearing, get rid of, like you said, his hate, his anger, his self introspection. And it's just a guy walking and it's just the bad timing between him and this cop. Right. But I was thinking, if your book was made into a movie today, do you think it would be closer to how you wrote it?
I have no idea. You know, that it's a hypothetical, but what, you know, with the, it's known now that I wasn't happy with the tone of the current film.
Tell us more about that too when you have when you get the
you
chance.
Mean the movie, the version out now, the latest edition.
My problem with the film is, and there's an irony here, because the character is as rage filled as my Rambo in the novel, but that novel then morphed into a series of films in which redemption was the theme. You know, that this troubled man would be struggling to find a redemption, and the rage in the current movie, and I texted Sly to say this to him. I said, you know, given the world as it is today, I think the movie should have given us hope rather than rage.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, an artist has a right to express what that person feels, but I, with my unique relationship with the character, I don't know if this has ever been a case before, where somebody who created a character in another form and saw it. I sometimes call myself Rambo's father because the character grew up and went directions that I, you know, had no control over. And I don't, you know, the second movie is a lot of fun. It's sort of like Tarzan,
right.
You know, it's it's a sort of modern Tarzan Western to me. But, you know, thinking of the current one, I give credit. Hey, Sly, if that was the film you wanted to make, that's your right. But in my unique situation, it is also my right to say, you know, I think maybe hope would have been better than rage.
How do you respond to your text?
We're, you know, kicking it back. You know, naturally, you know, we're the film is what it is, and my reaction is what it is. Yeah.
I wanted to still just stay with the book for a moment. Your in the book version that you wrote of Rambo, a couple things stuck out to me. One, there is no John Rambo. His name was just Rambo, which is now that name is just iconic. I mean, my mother-in-law named her cat Rambo, you know, and she's a very conservative Baptist, you know, so just Rambo. No. And in the book, it's just Rambo. There's not John. And the book is set in Kentucky, the South, if you will. And in the movie, they set it up in the Northwest. So I wanted to know, like, your thoughts there. Were you thinking more of that Southern conflict, and why just the Rambo name only? That's kind of like a iconic one name person.
I was interested in writing mentors was a man named Sterling Siliphant, Sillipant. And Sterling had, I knew Sterling, and Sterling had written the screenplay adapting John Ball's novel In the Heat of the Night with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger. And Sterling received the Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar for that. And when I, you know, it's inevitable, given my admiration for Sterling, that, you know, with Rambo and the story I was telling, that I thought, all right, I can put this in. I thought of Kentucky as being just farther north in the South, that it wouldn't be Cracker Barrel, right, but it would have that, what Americans recognize as that kind of Southern, flavor, for lack of a better.
So Cracker Barrel's been a way to make fun of the South since the 70s?
Well, I didn't want to. It wasn't making fun, you know, but
right.
Plus Kentucky has what's been called the Grand Canyon of the South. It has a dramatically wild, I don't know if it is now, but, you know, when I was writing it, that was the case. And some parts of it hadn't been mapped adequately. So I thought, all right, I can set it there. And in addition, I was writing the novel as I was a graduate student at Penn State. The Alleghenies, which I could experience, the mountains there, morph southward into the Cumberlands in Kentucky. So I thought, okay, you know, the locale, the physicality of it would be kind of the same. And, you know, I was using what I knew, in other words. For reasons to do with financing, Carolco Pictures, Carolco, made the Rambo, the first three Rambo films, and they had a deal in Canada. They figured out how to get, if they made a film in British Columbia, they would get some credits from British Columbia to help them make the film. Mm. And in addition, the difference between American and Canadian money was so great that also would help if they brought American money in to transfer it to Canadian money to make the film, so that they could make a film for $15, $16, $17 million. The budget number changes periodically for something that looked much, much more expensive. And even then, that wasn't small change in 1981 when right. the film was made. So I thought it was very interesting that that one of the producers, Andrew Vanya, whom I got to know pretty well and liked, that before they made the decision to go to British Columbia to pretend that the movie was set in, say, Washington State, that he phoned and said, is there any reason why this story won't work if we transfer it to the Pacific Northwest? And that's a shocking phone call. Producers do not call authors to ask them if the story will work if they do this and this. But that's the way Carolco and Andrew Vanya and Mario Casar operated. And my answer was no. The locale had simply been for my purposes, and that if they wanted to set it in the Pacific Northwest, it wasn't going to affect anything. And I've often thought about how interesting and kind of telling that phone call was about how they did business.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's great. And even I think in the movie, the green of being in Washington, I think it was set in like a small, what was Portland. The town? I think actually the town was called Hope.
It's a real town in British Columbia. It's actually called Hope, and they have a film festival every year with, you know, they show the Rambo films, and although many of the locations are gone, the bridge at the start where the police chief expects Rambo to keep going across the bridge and disappear, and Rambo comes back, that's been destroyed. So people go there trying to, you know, discover locations. Enough time has passed. Many of them no longer exist.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you too, though. So how did you come up with the name Rambo, and why just the one name?
Well, it's a hilarious. No, I think you know the answer. It's hilarious. And yet, when I teach writing, I always tell my students, ideas can come from the most unlikely sources. So never shut your mind off. Always be looking to seize on something that otherwise might not seem important. So my wife and I and our very small daughter were living in State College, Pennsylvania, where Penn State is located. And we did not have a lot of resources. So my wife, with 25 cents, had been able to buy a bunch of apples from a roadside stand. And oh boy, now we've got apples. Yeah. So I was working. We had a one bedroom, and my desk was in the bedroom when our daughter's crib was there, and our bed. And I'm in there typing away. And I knew the name had to have the sound of force. But I didn't have the name. And so as I'm writing, I've left these blank spots on the pages, and I'm using actual typing, you know, rather than people today are really spoiled with computers. Cause you know, it was a physical thing with a typewriter. So I've left all these gaps, And my wife comes in and says, I bought these apples. Hey, only 25 cents. Taste one. And I'm, you know, I'm in my inspired mode. So I'm saying, oh, yeah, yeah, leave me alone. And she says, no, bite the apple. And I just, I love to emphasize that, the mythic overtones of bite the apple.
Yeah.
And so, okay, I bit into the apple and it tasted pretty good. And it's almost inevitable. If you bite into an apple and it tastes pretty good, you're going to say, what's it called? That's just what people do. So I said, hey, tastes pretty good. What's it called? She said, it's called a Rambo apple. And I, you know, gaped for a second and said, what? Repeat that. She said, a Rambo apple. I said, spell it, R-A-M-B-O. And I, there I was. I had the name. And for people who might be confused, the Rambo apple is the popular apple in central Pennsylvania where we were then living. It's just that he hadn't experienced it yet, but I, you know, I knew immediately what to do with that name.
That's when I read about it, I still never had one of those. I don't, I didn't know at all. Yeah.
You won't find them in supermarkets, but if you go to, for a long time, maybe they still do. Penn State has something called the Nittany Lion Inn, which is their place where you know, where visitors stay. It's, you know, sort of a hotel on campus. Very nice, very old feeling, very elegant. And they usually have, at least the last time I was there, a big bowl of Rambo apples right there by the check-in desk. If you can, not because of me, I'm sure they don't even think about the connection, but it's a popular apple in that area.
It's a good thing she didn't give you a gala apple.
Or a Macintosh or a Granny Smith. Right.
Fuji First Blood,
yeah.
Granny, don't do it, Granny.
Granny Smith First Blood.
Yeah, Granny Smith First Blood, you're right. A Red Delicious First Blood, yeah. I wanted to ask you, okay, so my last name is Morrell too. And so Matt and I, we're in a band as well. And so we started our band back in the early 2000s, late 1990s. And when we told our family that we were going to do music for professionally, it was not received well. And I wonder, like, you said you were lucky enough to be around some authors, and that might have, like, kind of kindled some of that fire to be an author. But what was it like for you? Because you were an author, but like you said, you didn't even have, when you first were an author, you weren't making much resources. I'm sure there had to be times where you thought maybe give up and get the job that's better paying. Right. And even when you wrote Rambo, it didn't even become a – how much success was there? It was waited about a decade before it even became a movie.
Right? Well, yeah, lots of interesting stuff in there. The book was a big success in 72. It was reviewed everywhere. It was astonishing for a first novel how well it was reviewed. And while the advance wasn't much, it was $3,500, and I was making, mind you, $10,500 as an assistant professor at the University of Iowa. So it was maybe a quarter of my salary, so it might not sound like much. No, I have my doctorate's in American literature, so I teach, I taught American novel and things of that nature. I still think about that $3,500 because my agent said, you need an attorney for this movie contract. Also, there was a big paperback contract too. So, you know, it was for somebody who had no resources, it was a big shock, and we just saved it all. I never drew on any of that money. We just used it if we needed a car or something. But my agent said, you need an attorney for this movie contract. So, okay. And he says, it's going to cost you $500. And I thought, oh my God, my agent takes 10%. And then it's 500, and then I'm going to have to pay taxes on this. And by the time I'm done, you know, will there be anything left? And so he came back after a while, and it's sort of amusing. He said, David, I've got you protected so that if there was a minimal, it's not much, profit participation. And we got to remember that in the movies, profits are like the horizon. They recede infinitely, right? But it's nice to be. Nice to be able to, especially these days, right? It's nice to be able to say you had him, though. So he said, for $500, this is what you're getting. If there are sequels or remakes, you still have some profit participation. And I said, how can there possibly be sequels or remakes? Everybody's dead at the end.
Right.
And he said, David, you don't understand the movie business. If this picture ever gets made, it could be a musical comedy on a submarine.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
So, right. stuff happened. But you know what you say about music? Music was my first choice. I wanted to be, nobody knows about this stuff anymore, but I wanted to be Nelson Riddle. I wanted to be an arranger. Nobody arranges anymore in the same way. Mm-hmm. And I took serious music education. And then.
Well, it's composition either way, right? What you're arranging and composition are, I mean, we're getting in very similar territory there.
And overtones and undertones, you know, mm-hmm. structures of chords and mm-hmm. what underneath drives it. I'm fascinated by Jimmy Webb's music. I have a songbook of his, and if you're into music, you might, you know, this is a lot of people won't understand what we're talking about, but if he has an F chord in the bass, he has beneath it a D on the F chord to mm-hmm. support it. And, you know, that's not what I was taught. And, you know, his, and he plays the piano well enough to be able to support that chord. So basically it's an F sixth with the sixth underneath the F. And I mean, to me, this is astonishing, but that kind of undertone and thinking of structure in that way has a carryover into, the way, novels can be constructed.
Well, if you're going to talk about music theory, which is my native language, then I want to jump over and think about how you think about the nuts and bolts of writing and composition and narrative, because that's more of a hobby to me. But yeah, I understand that music stuff there. I hear that D as to make that an F6, you're trying to not hear it as a D minor, you know? You have to disguise that there to make that happen. I know exactly what you mean.
At about, you know, and I went through harmony, counterpoint, and orchestration. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I had certificates in these things, and I was very young. I was only like 16, but I was determined. I mean, music is fascinating, and I could in my day, I had an idiot savant gift, if we want to call it that, for reading chord symbols, and I could do four sharps and four flats for anything, so that I was hired a lot for dance bands, not rock bands, but dance bands, to do, to fill in if their pianist got sick, you know, with a half hour's notice, I could be there and I could do all the fill-ins for them because I knew what, you know, E flat seventh meant. Or, you know, a C diminished or F augmented or what have you.
And so you can comp along with jazz standards on the piano, no problem, today.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
But
that's
I could do. But if they said it's your turn for a solo, I said there's no way I could do solos. All you hear is rhythmic block chords.
Ah, wow. So I bet you have a similar brain to mine. To me, to improvise freely out of my voice without thinking about anything would be a dream come true. It's not something I can do. But I love chord structure. I love song structure. I love how it works. I like, I mean, those details are kind of my life. I'm really an arranger. I mean, that's actually probably the thing I'm most skilled at. But what does that mean for writing, though? What is the equivalent in writing? Open me to that window. What is your, how do you think of narrative theory or something?
Everything is structure. I start by writing a letter to myself in which I ask myself first, why is this project worth doing? And there's to be something about the theme and the way the book will be written and the research that makes it worth, say, a year of my life working every day. And then, you know, I start investigating, you know, what's it about? Where would the characters, what sort of characters would I need? What kind of setting? And then becomes the all-important question, how does it begin? And if so, then I wrestle with the whole idea of what my beginning, and as often I have different beginnings, and sometimes they lead me in bad directions, like First Blood, the novel, and I didn't know much about structure at the time. First Blood begins with the chase through the forest. And I thought, well, you know, that'll be exciting. People want to read on. But what I realized eventually was that we didn't know who these characters were, so we didn't care what happened to them. So the chase through the forest was meaningless. So I had to go backward until I finally said, it's when these two people first see each other. That's the beginning of the story. And then, as I mentioned, you know, I worked out this structure painfully. It wasn't obvious to me at the start that each chapter would alternate. So we'd have Rambo looking at the police chief and then the police chief looking at Rambo, and each of them reacting so that the reader, while they were in, while readers were in Rambo's mind, they'd say, "Oh, that awful policeman." But if they were in the policeman's mind, they'd say, "Oh, that awful Rambo." And so they'd always be switching their allegiances. And I mean, that's a good example of how structure is important. So once I know how the piece will begin, you know, then what it becomes the logical matter is saying, well, what if I begin this way, what is the next piece of narrative information that I need to provide the reader in order to move the story forward? And sometimes I don't anticipate enough, and I might be moving like two or three incidents ahead of where I should be, and I'll realize that, no, I got to fill this in, otherwise this later scene won't make any sense. So it's mostly James M. Cain. This is now, a lot of people are going to be walking away from us at this point. James M.
That's all right. I'm engaged fully.
Said that storytelling was like algebra, that it's A plus B plus C plus D equals the narrative. And A is a chapter, B is a chapter, C is a chapter, D is a chapter. So you have to arrange those chapters in the logical sequence of narrative information that will give you the emotional result that you're aiming for. And as I said, sometimes that isn't obvious until after the fact. And I'm working on a novel now. I've got hundreds of pages, and I still don't know what the heck the beginning chapter is. I write one, and I go about 50 pages, and I say, no, that's not, when I get here, the readers will not be with me. Mm. They will not understand what I'm going for. So then I start, I mean, I've got like four sequences of like 150 pages, each with a different beginning. And I finally said, this book isn't ready to be written, and I've started something else.
So that's very exploratory, wow, though, because I think a lot of people that are songwriters, for instance, now I'm with you, that is how I write music, is that exact way. But what I find for a lot of creatives is it just comes out that way. But those people are not willing to rearrange, and they're either talented or they're not, but they just write a story and it comes out, and they're not willing to trash it or reorganize it, and they don't try 10 different things. I mean, isn't there other types of writers who just start at the beginning and that's their process?
Well, I sort of do start at the beginning. You know, I'm outlining it in a way that I leaves a lot of room for, you know, discussion or for discovery, right? And, you know, a lot of what I'm aiming for is an emotional reaction. I mentioned Jimmy Webb before. I'm fascinated by him as a songwriter. And when he wrote what I consider to be one of the great, great songs, Wichita Lineman, I mean, it's so simple and powerful. But he said he got the idea. He was driving through, I don't know if it was in Kansas or Oklahoma, but very flat territory. And he's driving and he saw this truck and this person climbing this pole, you know, from several miles away. And he drove and he passed the guy and he kept going and he sees him in his rearview mirror. And he says, that's got to be the loneliest job in the world. And out of that started thinking how he could communicate that loneliness in a song. So, I mean, everybody's different, right? Everybody has a different way of doing things. And I'm very interested in the Ken Burns country music documentary that's been going on. I'm not quite done with it. I recorded it. But I'm at with the Hank Williams material where Williams just seems to have been visited. He seems to have had a title come to him and then all of a sudden was able to write a song in like 15 minutes, which didn't need any changing.
The lonesome. I heard Ken Burns talking about that too. Yeah.
And that to me is one of the, this like Wichita Lineman, one of the great songs, you know, and it's interesting. There's no bridge in I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. You know, it's just, it's repeated. And what I noticed was that, you know, some there may be some key changes in there. I'd have to go back and listen, but you know, that's about as haiku like a song as there can be, and it just sort of comes to him. I, you know, how enviable an ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be able to notice it and then have the craft to be able to support it, but to be able to notice that inspiration is the big time, because that's what I'm at in song. I've been doing songs forever, thinking it was about the notes and the chord structure. That's what I've always thought. And now I'm at this other place like, wait a minute, if I understood the lyrics here, my decision-making would be so much easier. If I just understood what we were trying to do instead of just guessing until it seems right or interesting, then it just gives you a razor to make the decisions with so easily.
there's a, you know, the, on a parallel, Frank Sinatra, whom I have a keen interest in, not as a actor or as a public person, but as a singer who can be demonstrated was the greatest American interpretive singer of the 20th century. And what Frank would do, because he wasn't a songwriter, but he was emotive, and what he would take a song, and the lyrics would be sort of, you know, on a lead sheet near him, and he would get pen and paper and he would write the lyric as if he were inventing it. And he would then crush that paper and throw it away and then write the lyric again as if he was writing it, each time investing his emotion into the lyric. And that's one reason why Frank was able to give the illusion of telling us the secrets of his soul, because he had so internalized those lyrics. And one could argue, you know, and there are examples of this with fine melodies, but if you don't have the lyric to match it, that song is not going to sing.
Well, that speaks to singing being like acting, which I think is very much the case. If you think about a method actor, they give their entire self to the role. So when you say what Frank was doing there, that's what I hear, is he had to trick himself into thinking it was his idea, and then he could really sell it.
And if you look at now, one of his idols was Billie Holiday, and Billie did that, although she didn't write down the lyrics, but you know she internalized. But if we look at a contrasting singer that Frank admired, Ella Fitzgerald, there are very few, as great a singer as she was, if you listen to her, each song pretty much sounds the same. You know, it's about the vocalizing, not about the interpreting. But Frank was an interpreter, and even when he wasn't singing so good at the end, not one could argue from after his retirement on. He retired in 1970, and then came back in 71, 72. After that, his voice wasn't quite the same, but it didn't matter because he could make us believe the lyric, and that's you know, for me, what popular singing is about.
Wow. I wanted to ask you too.
This territory all day, but I'll let that all go.
Yeah, I know. Well, I wanted to ask you one last question here. Just talking about your structure and the way you write. I didn't know this about you, but you and your wife lost your son Matthew to Ewing's sarcoma, is a rare form of cancer, bone cancer, I believe. And I wanted to say, you wrote a book called Fireflies that delves into that. And then I think there's another book that you wrote too that I'm not as familiar with, Desperate, I think, that also talks about the loss of a son. But I wanted to know, capturing that emotion and feeling that and then putting it into words, what was that experience like for you?
Well, sometimes I think writing can be a form of what we might call scriptotherapy, which is we write to try to understand our emotions or maybe to expunge them. And after our son died, it's a very rare bone cancer that causes growths on the bones. And Matt was 15 when this happened. And it's very rare to the point that only 200 people get the disease each year in the United States. And many years later, recently in 2000, Matt died in 1987. Recently in 2009, my 14-year-old granddaughter, Natalie, died from the same rare bone cancer. Only 200 people get it each year. And the problem was, you know, for us, I mean, how do you relate to that? I mean, that's a cosmic kind of, because it's not supposed to be inherited. Yes, back when Matt died, I wrote a couple of books about grief, and, you know, a lot for myself, but other people in grief took something from those books. And then after Natalie died in 2009, I tried a different way. I became fascinated by the Victorian era, and I escaped. I thought I was time traveling. It was that intense, the immersion in the research materials. And I wrote about a real life person in 1850s named Thomas De Quincey, who had invented the concept of the subconscious way before Freud. And so there I was writing a series of mystery thrillers about the guy who'd invented the concept of the subconscious while I'm trying, you know, to dig into to ex- you know, to get all the grief out of me. And so in that case, I wrote three of those books. I spent 4 or 5 years on those books, and you know, they basically were a form of scriptotherapy for me to help me.
That is so awesome to hear. Thank you for sharing that, because it's just I hear that so pure in a world where people think, oh, there's scripts and movies and you get a book deal and you get signed to a record deal and you get a bunch of chicks and you make money or you get famous or you get a lot of Spotify plays. You're making art that resonates and is real for the reasons of stuff like getting the grief out of you. Yeah. That's why people make stuff. That's so heartening to hear.
These days, as you said, with Spotify and all that, and you know, Jimmy Webb, I had a chance, in fact, to meet Jimmy when he performed here, and I actually have my photograph with him, which I'm honored to have. And Jimmy was saying, you know, royalties, you don't get it. It's hardly anything now for music, and with books too. The money now, there are still some big book deals, but for the most part, the average author does not make the kind of money that people think authors do. And I only know the only reason to do this is as a vocation, not a profession, and is to use our abilities to express ourselves in order to understand ourselves better and maybe help other people understand themselves better. And otherwise, you're chasing the market and you're always, oh, you know, I'm not number one, or I'm not this, or I'm not that. These are all false values. And if Hemingway said talent, determination, and luck, and he said don't underestimate luck, and you know, all that's out of my control. All I can do, I have a mantra, which I suppose would apply to musicians as much as it does to writers, is be a first-rate version of yourself and not a second-rate version of another author or musician. And the second mantra is don't chase the market, you'll always see its backside.
That's exactly right. There's something about it when you create something new that you know it originated from you, like a desire you had to find something. When you achieve it, there's nothing, you know it's right. Like you can't, it's not for a reason other than it was already intrinsically the value of what you just accomplished, you know. And that's the thing.
If it has a life of its own, which is a matter of luck often, hooray. You did not waste your time writing something that was not authentic for you.
Well, how do you distinguish vocation and what did you
say? Profession.
Profession.
I thought I liked that distinction.
I'm happy, you know. I mean, my mother didn't raise an idiot. I like to, you know, be able to eat and sleep in a safe room and all that. So naturally, when I write, I make certain decisions that are predicated upon, you know, I'm not going to write a musical comedy on a submarine. Let's put it that way. So what I write is compatible with the market, but what I write within that, within thrillers or mysteries and what have you, is what I like to think is unique. And I, you know, the people when they read a book by mine, they say, yes, that's a David Morrell book. That's not me imitating somebody else. And I, you know, I like to think they come to my work, you know, for that, whatever personality it is in there. So while it's a profession for sure, you know, we like to be recompensed for our efforts. But the vocation part of it is, you know, we do this for, you know, personal urgings, for lack of a better expression.
Yeah. David, that's been phenomenal. True. I mean, I couldn't have been more pleased and intrigued and engaged in an interview. We really do appreciate your time. Thanks for giving us so much information and stuff.
Well, it's fun to talk about music. I still write songs. I don't do anything with them, but things will come to me. Frank Sinatra heard music in his head all the time, and I, you know, that happens to me. And so I noodle I write them down. I can, as we discussed, I can actually put them on paper, and occasionally I show them to fellow musicians. But you know, I have no illusions about my place in musical society. But it sure can be soothing and exciting.
Absolutely, resonate to me as. I mean, I think this is satisfying to me in the sense that you're a generation ahead of me, and I think we're isolated from people that are not our age, but it's just so, there's so many similarities in the way you think and are doing. To see that in a generation beyond is I'm glued to it. And you're like a DIY, do-it-yourself, figure-out-your-own-way punk rocker guy. Yeah. Still doing it. It makes me so happy.
That's the search. That's what I was talking about Sterling Silicon in Route 66. And, you know, two guys trying to find. I did talk about that, right? Mm-hmm. And we covered Sterling, so many things. Well, because I did an interview earlier, and I talk about Sterling often, and I didn't want to sound like I'm talking about something that I hadn't. But Sterling had grown up in the back seat of a traveling salesman's car. And he was a journeyer, and that's what Route 66 was about. And he was always looking ahead and voyaging and discovering, and that just became inbred in me. And when my wife and I moved to Penn State from Canada to study, for me to go to grad school there, that was part of the deal. We're leaving our country, for heaven's sake. I'm now an American citizen, but as well as a Canadian citizen. But we said, oh, what the heck? Yes, let's try it. It's going to be an adventure. And that's always been my goal here. You know, I start writing about Rambo and First Blood, and my previous three books were about a guy in 1850s, Thomas De Quincey, who invented the concepts of subconscious, and I'm writing imitations of Victorian thrillers. Well, how big a jump can that be? And yet, yeah, that's the whole idea that, you know, there is if we don't grow, if we don't change, if we don't look ahead, you know, what are we doing?
Yeah,
I know. What are we here for? And right. Why would you want to stop when you're 30 or 40? It doesn't make any sense.
Some of you know people like that too.
Yes. That's what most people are like.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hate to make, you know, I hear what you're saying, and you know, I've been fortunate to meet people who are, you know, of like minds, but you know, that should be the goal, that each day we get up and say, all right, how are we going to change today?
Yes.
That's great. Dave, we didn't even have time to get into everything. I wanted to talk about you working with Marvel and doing the comic books and all that stuff. So maybe one day we can get you back on. We'd love to talk more music and all that
this
stuff.
This has been fun. You know, we can talk especially more about the comic books were another way of looking forward. I wrote about Captain America, Spider-Man, and Wolverine. Quite a trifecta. Yeah. And, you know, I let's do it. Let's find out. Yeah. I mean, in truth, you know, somebody offered me a chance to write a play, you know, even a musical using the music, you know, stuff that we talked about. I'd love to do it. If it's different and I can learn from it and it's a challenge and it'd be exciting, why not?
Oh, that sounds so good. That sounds so good. David, we really appreciate it. Everybody can find you. Is the easiest place maybe at davidmorell.net, I believe is your website. They can find that. And let's leave everybody. If everybody,
lots of information.
Yeah, lots of. First Blood, what's a good book for people to get into you with? Like a good starter, when you would say.
People sometimes, it depends on how they feel about the character, Rambo, but a different one would be The Brotherhood of the Rose.
Yeah.
Brotherhood of the Rose was an espionage novel I wrote in 1984. It was the first novel to combine the U.S. and U.K., British spy novel traditions, combining the action of the American spy novel with the authentic spy tradecraft of the UK novel. And that had not been done before. It was a really great success for me. And beyond that, it became, I love to be able to say this, it became the basis for the only TV miniseries to air after a Super Bowl. I just think that's so cool to be able to say that. So The Brotherhood of the Rose, and then there were two follow-up books, The Fraternity of the Stone and The League of Night and Fog. And then I stopped writing spy novels. I'd done that. Yeah. I just moved in other directions. So, but I think people would be very satisfied if they look at The Brotherhood of the Rose.
Yeah, who were the actors in the TV version?
Robert Mitchum.
Yep.
Was in it. And then Connie Selica played one of the characters. Yep, David Morse, who is still acting, and Peter Strauss.
Yes.
Who was at one time considered the king of miniseries. It was a great cast. And to show you how things can interconnect, Sterling Siliphant was none other than the executive producer of the miniseries, The Brotherhood of the Rose. So not only did he inspire me to be a writer, but he and I actually worked professionally together.
Oh, that's awesome. Dave, we really have enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time today. We sure do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. David Morrell, not my dad, but in some ways I wish you were.
Good one. Okay. Well, I think you're right. It's probably better than your dad.
Yeah. Well, that was, okay. So I made a joke, and for him to respond on Twitter, I immediately thought, okay, he is 76 years old, but I was like, this is cool. There's going to be something good here. And the dude wrote Rambo. So this is, I just thought that was so good. And then some other tweets, you know, he talked to about being, you know, not liking the new movie, which I'm assuming the new movie, how strange is it that the first Rambo, they lightened it, made the character like, the victim mm-hmm. and endearing. And then as each Rambo got more and more, it became more vicious than what David wrote.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Like I was thinking, I asked him that question. I believe now though, if you wrote the first Rambo or the first Blood came out, the first film, were to come out now, I do believe it would be more like the book. I think people now tend towards
more ready for the anti-hero,
the non-hero. Yeah,
right.
You know, there isn't a hero, and you're just telling a story. I was thinking, like, just recently, I rewatched the Departed on the plane, which it hasn't stood the test of time as much as I thought. When I first saw the Departed with Leo and all the actors and all that stuff, you know, the gangster movie, mm-hmm. I thought it was so amazing. And when I watched it on the plane on this last week, I was like, it's still good. But it's not so much, but even in this movie, you don't, they are crossing the lines with who's the hero. I guess it's DiCaprio, but also, you know, he's hiding and not telling the truth to the bad guys. And, you know, and Jack Nicholson is the main bad guy, but also he's an FBI informant and all that stuff. And so it's funny that Sylvester Stallone would come full circle around with Last Blood, and it's it potentially might be the most vicious, violent, one of all.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm on this whole other level of thinking about that guy and how much I enjoyed that conversation, in the sense that I'm telling you, and I said this before, we are in devastatingly isolated age group echo chambers. It's not it's age. You have to be around people that have walked your path ahead of you.
Right.
How stupid is it that I don't have mentors like him? How ridiculous is that?
I agree.
Like, I just need that. I feel so automatic when you hear, wait a minute, you're somebody that thinks like me or has been trying to do something like that. Like, you're trying to do something. It's so clear. That's what I feel like. It's, where does this lead? And all people can do that? Or they still did? Or, you know, like, I feel so isolated. Like, well, there's nobody else that does like me. But that's not true. Of course it's not true.
Well, the big mistake that everybody makes is the information that he can provide you isn't old. It's just experience. So we relate, he's 76.
No,
so things are different now. That has nothing to do with the information that he can give you, which is super valuable, interesting, and entertaining. I mean, gosh, I was so captivated the whole time.
But they're usually not good at technology. So if we only live in technology, we're isolated from the people. I mean, in the future, it won't be as bad of a problem, I don't think. But for
you want to start a 70 years old and up only podcast.
Well, that would be great if you could. But it would be. I don't know the format or have a specific idea there, but yes, I do want that, because what I'm saying is that's just me resonates with him, or goes, I can see myself for the rest of my life thinking, oh, I'll be in his study doing that when I'm that. I now have a model. I'll think about that forever. It'll be a part because it can't. There is that. It's more like that feeling. It's not that he knows everything or I'm really like him or something. It's not that. It's just, it just helps you. It's modeling. And that's what parenting is. And we're so isolated. We move to the city. We live urban. We only hang out with our peers. We only go to our job and the Facebook group we're in. You're supposed to be freaking stuck together with babies and old people all the time. That's how you're supposed to develop and learn. I mean, I'm real big on child development, and it's clearly child development happens because I'm older than the child. And then that interplay. So I would like to continue. I don't believe in child development ending when you turn 18. And then now they say, 25 till you're... No, you idiot. Your whole life is development. It's human development, not child development. And part of it is older people that, you know, it just seems so obvious. And it just highlights what you know, some things we're doing wrong that I don't know much solution for. But I think
you're right. Well, it's just people just get too caught up in the idea of, you're right, that we're in a technological age and things are moving faster and you can't take some of the life lessons of other people. And that's just a mistake. It's a huge mistake. Everything he was talking about, even that's what I'm saying. That's why Rambo is so, the story of Rambo, the book, is very relevant to today and what it means to be power and law enforcement, and all of those things can be very valuable today, and how it's depicted and what it means to be free and not be free, and the stories. And I mean, that's just all of that. But
I think the most of the learning happens, though, and that's kind of what I think about is this podcast, and it reinforces that, is you learn just having dinner with people, hanging out with people. I don't really want to take his class or his master class video course on how to write a book. I mean, not that. I just want to have supper every night with the person that's also way interested in how Frank Sinatra uses a microphone and what to do, what breaths indicate and mean in recordings. Holy shit.
I know.
There's a 76-year-old man that thinks like that and has been thinking about it and writing about it. Right. Holy shit. You know,
I know. I agree.
I just want to talk informally about that, and that's how it works. I don't know. That's just me, though.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what isn't just you, Matt, because it's me, too, and a bunch of people, actually. It's old the BC Club. The BC Club.
Oh, that's everybody. That's universal. Yeah.
I mean, we have some older folks in the BC Club, by the way, who are very valuable. And I won't say their names just because I don't want them to think I'm talking about them. But there's some older.
But you know who you are, and you're older.
You older
70,
ladies and gentlemen in the BC Club are very valuable. And I actually do think there is something to be said about their life experience being valuable. I do believe as I'm getting older, parts of my life are becoming more valuable to other people, like where it used to be more, you know, the more I can think about, oh, I've experienced this and pass that on, not in a I'm preaching to you and teaching you, but just like how we just talked with David. David's just talking. He didn't give any advice to me or much or anything. He's just saying, hey, this is what I did and this is what you should do, and this is what is possible.
This is how this works. This is how that works, is what I hear.
Right. So that. But anyway, back to the BC Club. It is the reason you're listening to this podcast is one, almost the main reason is, well, first of all, Matt and I are super smart and intelligent, and we have all kinds of people on the podcast. Yeah, but also, the BC Club, it is a way to support what you are hearing right now. And if you're hearing, you're enjoying, well
why
if not
you're still listening at this point, let's be honest.
That's true. Yeah, let's
be honest. Still
if you're still here, you got a problem if you don't pay a couple bucks here.
There's something wrong with you if you are not in the BC Club and you're listening to my voice right now.
So you get extra podcasts. We're doing all kinds of things like the BC Con. We've got some other stuff in the works that will be coming in the future. So there's a lot going on. If you like this podcast, and then help us make it. We sure would appreciate it. It really does help a lot. And I want to give a couple of names here of some of the people in the BC Club. All right. So we have Milford Reed Sheffer. I'm giving them an old name to start with. Okay. Is that okay with you?
You're adding a name.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bertha Kenneth Hahn. See if you can tell what the old name is I'm adding.
Okay.
Edna Lauren Sanborn.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I only got women's names here. Let's see here. I'm going to do this one with Sandberg. I'm sorry. Gertrude Jason Slagle. And Harold Patrick Dye.
You got it.
They are in the BC Club. Thank you, folks. That's your old names.
A Sanborn and a Sandberg consecutively.
Oh, yeah. It was Lauren Sanborn and Michael Sandberg.
Thank you guys both.
I wonder if they're from the same place in the world, but their names got changed a little bit. Anyway. All right, folks, go tell an older person you love them and just give them a listen instead of being such a young asshole.
Assholes. Yeah, now, I'm just setting this up because please listen to me when I'm older.
Yeah, dear God.
Just
sit beside me at the bench and just let me talk.
Stuff when I get
just
older.
Let me talk. Maybe bring a piece of candy, but let me talk.
I'll be hanging out by the cooler at the gas station, leaning against or something outside of a gas station, or possibly at a table at McDonald's, or possibly on the tee box of a golf course. Not playing, really. Just waiting around while other people tee off. That's where I'll be.
I'll be at a Hardee's with my senior discount coffee, and I just want you to come over, say, hey, I'd love to listen, and just hand me a Werther's. Hand me a one Werther's and I'll be good.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. That's what I need. All right. See y'all later.